for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. More than 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. As the country ages, that number is expected to increase dramatically, yet we rarely hear from those struggling to live with the diagnosis. For this month's Reader's Review, a novel written from the perspective of a woman who has early-onset Alzheimer's. The book is titled Still Alice by Lisa Genova. The film adaptation is out in movie theaters now. Joining me, Lynn Neary of NPR, Howard Fedoroff of Georgetown University School of Medicine, playwright Trish Vredenburg of Us Against Alzheimer's, and novelist Stefan Merrill Block. Throughout the hour, I do invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call, whether you've read the book, seen the movie. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Our number, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
It's great to be with you.
Good to see you all. Lynn Neary, as the novel opens, Alice Howland is a very successful, very articulate professor of psychology at Harvard, a specialty in linguistics. Fill her out for us.
Well, as you said, this is you couldn't pick a candidate for early Alzheimer's, an onset of early Alzheimer's that's better, really, than Alice Howland, because she is such a successful, such an articulate woman. She has lived her entire life in the mind. She is someone who, for whom education is extremely important. She has three children and a husband who also is a very successful academic. They're both at Harvard. So this is someone whose whole life has been involved in language. And little by little, her language, that's where it begins. It begins with forgetting words, which I think a lot of us identify with almost immediately. That sort of not being able to remember a word or remember a date or something like that. And but it comes on very slowly, and she just attributes it to, she's turning 50 as the book begins, and they're celebrating her birthday. And everything seems like it's fine, except for these tiny little things start happening until then some bigger events occur, like she's standing in the middle of Harvard Square, where she has been every day of her life for the last, I guess, 20, 30 years or something, and she cannot remember how to get to her house.
She cannot remember. And, Stefan, the book is actually written from her perspective, but it's in the third person. How did you feel about that? How did that help the novel or make it more difficult?
Well, I thought it was the right decision. You know, it's no surprise to me that this novel has really become the go-to book for Alzheimer's sufferers and their families. And it's no surprise that it's fiction. You know, fiction can serve many different functions. And one of them, I think, one of the great pleasures as a reader is to see your own story on the page, to find yourself on the page. In the case of Alzheimer's disease, however, fiction has a vital role because it can, it is the act of the imagination that can allow us to penetrate this very lonesome, alienated headspace. Mm. I think that my impulse to write fiction was born of my own family's experience with Alzheimer's disease. When I was a homeschooling kid in Texas, my grandmother came to stay with us for a while, and she was on this process that scientists call retrogenesis, which means like a sort of return to birth. Her mind was rewinding, so I was a 12-year-old kid growing up, and she was growing backward. And we were at this moment when I was, hungry for friends, that we were at this moment of equipoise, where we were sort of both neurologically 12 years old. And so in that moment, she was my best friend. But then I continued to grow and she continued to regress. And the only way I could understand where she had gone was to imagine. And so I think that was when I became a fiction writer, was when I was trying to to enter into that lonesome headspace. And as, you know, so it grew into my own first novel, which deals with Alzheimer's disease, called The Story of Forgetting. And as I have been reading and writing about Alzheimer's, I've been asking myself this basic question, which was the question that my experience with my grandmother confronted me with, which is, when a person, you know, as Alzheimer's disease wears away a person's personhood, is the person that's left still really who that person, or is this a radically transformed other self? And in my reading of, you know, I've read, there's all of a sudden all these wonderful Alzheimer's novels, I've seen that there are two basic ways this goes. There are novels in which this person remains fully intact, trapped behind the sort of amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles of the disease. But they're like a totally remembering, coherent self that's just struggling to speak. I don't think that's exactly true. I don't think that's true to the pathology of the disease. Unfortunately, those representations are the most common, like Nicholas Sparks' The Notebook, for example. And then there are other portrayals of Alzheimer's disease that show a radically transformed, often nullified self. You know, sometimes those can be grim books. I think Still Alice falls somewhere in between. And I think that the third person is absolutely the right choice for this book because, you know, it can show us this disintegrating, transforming self, and still kind of leave open to us the space for us to imagine where it is that she goes.
Trish Freidenberg, you too know Alzheimer's firsthand because your mother had it. Tell us how what you've read in Still Alice compares or contrasts to your own experience seeing your mother.
Well, my mother was, to me, you know, larger than life, this incredible lioness who could do anything. I mean, we went to Kennedy's inaugural because she allegedly won New Jersey for Kennedy. And so this woman could capture a room just by entering. Anything she could do, except she couldn't fight Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's has one scenario. And so I saw her in Alice, part of which, you know, smart people can hide. So my mother, who was, I think, somewhat hypochondriacal at one point, refused to go to a doctor. But when we got the diagnosis, and, you know, we knew that that's what she had, and it wasn't easy. I mean, doctors start, when they know that you have Alzheimer's, they don't talk to you anymore, so they talk over you. But like Alice, she was still there. I mean, so I saw this woman disappear into the unforgiving chasm, the abyss of Alzheimer's. And yet, when we would go to a nursing home, she, you know, when she was in her latest stage, she was still there. She saw my husband, whom she adored. And she, all of a sudden, a woman who didn't talk, became Scarlett O'Hara, trying to, you know, flirt with my husband. And she was still there.
Still there. And, Dr. Fedorov, the question becomes, is the portrayal of Alice in this book, how does that conform to what you see as a neurology professor encountering people with Alzheimer's?
Right. So the important issue is that Alice has the relatively rare form. This is the early onset where she and other members in her family have a mutation in one of the three genes that can cause early onset Alzheimer's disease. And of course, she presents at the age of 50. So that is atypical for the more common version, the late-onset Alzheimer's disease, which tends to present after age 65. The temporal progression of her symptoms does comport with what is seen across the Alzheimer's spectrum. It's aggressive in her case, and I think that they track very carefully the evolution of her symptoms. And I found intriguing both the way that she, as well as her sort of nuclear family, her daughters, son, and her husband, were interacting with her as that was evolving. And that family dynamic is also one that's experienced for families who have Alzheimer's.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, at the very earliest stages, you know, I thought the first sort of sentinel event was she was giving an invited lecture, and a lecture she probably gave in many elements many times before. And just in the middle of that talk, she could not find a key word that was critical to whatever the conveyance of the content she intended. It came to her later. And then just jump a few months, and as was mentioned briefly, when she became disoriented in Harvard Square and had this moment of panic where she did not know which way to go. Many of the familiar landscapes, so that sort of visual spatial disorientation was rather profound. It resolved, and she was able to find her way home.
And is that somewhat typical?
Yes.
As well. All right. Howard Fedoroff, Lynn Neary, Trish Vredenburg, Stefan Merrill Block, they're all here to talk about this wonderful novel and the film, which you may already have seen. Join us. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And from Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
And for this month's Reader's Review, we're talking about Lisa Genova's best-selling novel, Still Alice. The extraordinary part of this, of course, is that Lisa Genova self-published this, and then it was purchased by a big publisher and has ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. Here in the studio, Lynn Neary of NPR, Howard Fedoroff, neurology professor at Georgetown University and executive dean of the School of Medicine. Trish Vredenburg is a former sitcom writer and novelist who wrote Surviving Grace, a play about her mother and Alzheimer's. She and her husband, George, co-founded Us Against Alzheimer's. And Stefan Merrill Block is the author of two novels, The Story of Forgetting and The Storm at the Door. His article, A Place Beyond Words, The Literature of Alzheimer's, appeared in the August 2014 issue of The New Yorker. Back to the novel. Lynn, what did you make of the relationship between Alice and her three children, Lydia, Anna, and Tom.
Well, let me start out by confessing that I didn't really want to read this book.
Really?
No. When I heard it was a book about Alzheimer's, I just thought, no, I just don't want to read about Alzheimer's.
Because
I thought it was going to be a very difficult book to read on a very difficult subject, that it was going to be a very dramatic family tragedy. And so telling it from her perspective, I think, allowed you to look at it in a different way. And you were seeing her children from her perspective, not from their perspective. And I think it made the read much easier. It was an interesting way to look at it. It went really fast, I have to say. This book went incredibly fast.
I agree.
And it was very interesting seeing how all the members of the family reacted from her perspective. And I liked that. On the other hand, even though I didn't really want to go into a really sad, tragic family book, I do think it glossed over a little bit some of what the pain of being a relative of somebody with Alzheimer's really is. For instance, the husband at a certain point wanted to move to New York from Boston because to advance his career. And he was thinking of himself at a certain point, and his kids were saying, "You can't do that, Dad." Well, all of a sudden, he was in New York. They had resolved this very nicely, and you never really knew exactly how they had resolved it. And I thought, that's a really thorny issue they had to sort out, and we never found out how they did it.
And the other aspect of this, when she first told her children,
right,
the different reactions, Anna, who's so concerned about herself, her own pregnancy, she's had difficulty, immediately thinks, oh, my God, am I inheriting this? Am I going to pass it on to my own children? Tom, the son, sort of, he's mushy.
Yeah.
I don't really get a whole lot from him. But Lydia, the rebellious daughter, whom Alice thinks of as really the smartest of her children, has refused to go to college. She wants to be an actress, but she is so strong. The other aspect of this, Howard Fedoroff, is that Lisa Genova weaves in technical aspects of the disorder into her narrative. How successfully do you think she did that?
I think she did a very excellent job in weaving in sort of common understanding of what causes the disease in this particular form. That mutation produces disease in 100% of people. It's about making too much amyloid, this toxic protein. The influence that I think her husband becomes directed towards is first in human or then later stage clinical trials, believing that that would provide an opportunity for hopefully a natural history modifying therapy is, I think, very realistic. So I think it's really masterfully done, and I think it's very intelligently woven into the fabric of the story about she and her family.
Trish, how did you and your brother react to the realization that your mother had Alzheimer's? How does it compare to what you read here?
Well, my brother was in Berkeley, still waiting for the revolution. And so he, you know, and we were in New Jersey. And so my father and I had the day-to-day, you know, experience with my mom. My brother was in a lot more denial, and so when he would come to visit her, you know, and he was a professor and busy, I get that, but he just didn't want to really deal with it, and he would say, not, you know, you have Alzheimer's, but he would go, I know you're very depressed, this is a hard thing to be here in this environment, but he never connected with what was really, I think, going on in her. It was just really hard for him. We didn't know about, you know, anything that was going on. This was really sort of in a very incipient stage of when people knew about Alzheimer's. They certainly, as really now, hadn't come out of the closet. We need them to come out of the shadows and connect with this disease and, well, and be like they were in HIV/AIDS in the 90s when those people came out and said, you know, we have AIDS, and you've got to do something about it.
Do you think we're in denial, Stefan?
About the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease? I mean, I think we're in less and less denial. You know, I read somewhere that in the 1970s, Alzheimer's disease, diagnosis of Alzheimer's was about as common as Huntington's. And now, you know, I think it is, you know, recognized as an epidemic. I think one of the brilliant things that Lisa Genova has done in this novel is to make the sufferer a sufferer of early onset Alzheimer's. I think one of the problems with public perception of Alzheimer's is that there's still this lingering belief that somehow it is a natural part of aging. We all have memory loss as we age, but Alzheimer's disease is a separate, you know, neurological condition. And I think to put that into someone in the prime of their life, at the peak of their career and their responsibilities, makes us think about it differently.
Wow.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I went to go see the film of Still Alice this weekend, I just thought that something sort of miraculous was happening here, which is we have this, you know, this beautiful, still quite youthful actress portraying someone with Alzheimer's disease. And even if you don't end up seeing the film, just that idea is in the public's perception that someone like Julianne Moore, someone of her age, could have Alzheimer's disease, I think shifts the conversation.
Lynn, tell us about the butterfly folder on Alice's computer.
Oh, the butterfly folder. Now I'm testing my own memory. What was on that folder? She had this list of questions to herself, and there were five questions, and I forget what the questions were. And one thing about reading this book is that every time you forget anything after you've read this book, you start worrying.
Yeah.
But so she had a list of five questions, which she kept going to, and the idea was that if she got to a point, one of them was one of her kids' birthdays, I think. What was her birthday? And if she went to these questions, and where was her office was another one. So when she started out, the office was a specific address in Cambridge, and the daughter's birthday was a specific date. And she periodically through the book goes back to it because she's testing herself, and she's written herself a letter saying, if you can't answer these, then at this point... Does she say it at the beginning? Right at the beginning.
She does.
Yeah. That if you can't answer these, she has written a letter to herself saying, basically, she wants to take her own life once she cannot answer them.
And what she does is direct herself to go to a specific drawer in her bedroom,
right.
Trish.
Right. And at that point, she tries many times to follow it. She has to go back for her computer to take her upstairs. Because she's waited actually too long to follow this. And that directive.
She's got pills waiting.
She's got pills that she just put in the back of her drawer so that no one would see it. And when she finally gets to it, she is upset by someone coming in and drops them and still really can't connect with what she's supposed to do. And it becomes a pretty hairy situation.
And also the answers to the questions gradually get more vague over the course of the book. It goes from an exact date to, oh, April, and then, oh, no, maybe it's May. And the address gets less specific as you go along,
right.
Till you know that she's really losing her grip.
But I did want to ask Dr. Fedoroff. I know you're saying that this is a very, very small group of people who have this early onset, but I just didn't want it to be confused with early onset affects maybe 500,000 people, so that's a lot of people. This is just a small part of that group.
That's correct.
Okay.
A small part of that group.
Of the early onset group, I mean, and that's 10% of the 5 million.
So does Genova believe that it's worth living with Alzheimer's or not?
I think one of the narratives that is so interesting to trace over the course of this book is really this deep question, which is, you know, I think a question for our times, this time when, you know, we modify our behavior with psychopharmaceuticals and, you know, genetic modifications as well, which is, you know, what is it that makes me me? You know, and it's interesting that she chooses these questions. These are the things that she has decided, these four questions, five questions. These are the things that if I can't answer these, I'm no longer myself. And yet, of course, she fails the suicide attempt and she persists into this other space, this like the title of my article, A Place Beyond Words. And she finds, you know, the book is called Still Alice. And it's interesting, I think, to ask, is she still Alice? Yeah.
Is she still
Alice? But it doesn't get to end stage Alzheimer's.
That's right.
It doesn't. I mean, she's still, you know, she is still very much herself at the end of this book. And it can get to a much darker place, I think, than that.
She did go through a number of tests with neurologists. What kinds of tests are in reality available, Howard?
Well, for the most part, I mean, early on, given her age, it was reasonable to ask the question whether she may carry a mutation. And so in consultation with her neurologist and others, one of the issues was, well, what will you do with that information? It will have implications for you, your planning, and as well, perhaps your children, if you did test positive. And so that is a conversation that does occur in families when there is an earlier presentation.
It used to be that the only definitive way to know that you had Alzheimer's was in autopsy.
Correct.
How has that changed?
Yeah, so, you know, the general clinical approach to this is the definition of probable Alzheimer's disease, and the criteria were recently revised, and if you fulfill those criteria, you have probable Alzheimer's disease. And even though we have other imaging modalities that can help to shore up the probable Alzheimer's disease, it is still not absolutely certain until postmortem.
But is there a blood test to tell you whether you are likely to develop it?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, our work has been focused on a blood test in older individuals to determine what can be measured and what the accuracy of those measurements are that would predict. And we started off with an observation that in individuals over age 70, we could predict with greater than 90% accuracy.
Interesting.
And the work is extended, and we now believe that we've improved the accuracy very substantially. And so the question will be, this is in late-onset Alzheimer's disease, to be distinguished from the familial earlier onset, is whether that will become, in time, a tool that could be used clinically.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's make sure to get our listeners in on this discussion. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Michael in Jamison, Pennsylvania. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I would like to, put you on the hook, and your readers, or listeners, should I say, I actually live with Alzheimer's disease. And I would like to challenge everybody here today listening, how do we take this movie, which I believe is really great, to really expand upon the knowledge of what it may be like to live with dementia in itself, and make this movie become what Philadelphia was for the movement to start HIV.
And Trish, that is the very aspect you and your husband George are working on through Us Against Alzheimer's.
Yes, first of all, go to usagainstalzheimers.org and sign up. What we have to do is demand from Congress to give up. It's an equal opportunity disease, you know. Republicans, independents, Democrats get it. I often tell, you know, them in Congress, if you want to avoid this disease, die young. If you don't want to do that, you've got to do something, because this is the most expensive disease there is. So we need to have people come out of the shadow and totally write to their congressmen, demand from our government what, you know, what we need to have. We're getting $550 million for research. HIV/AIDS, which is a manageable, manageable disease, is getting $3 billion. I don't want their chunk necessarily. I want a bigger pie because this is what's going to affect all of us.
And to you, Howard, is the population of Alzheimer's growing because the baby boomers are reaching that point?
Yeah, for the most common form, the late onset age is the single greatest risk factor.
I see. And what we're dealing with here in Still Alice is a very different story because, as we've all said, she really is in the prime of life. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more of your comments, questions. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, providing small businesses and nonprofits email and online marketing tools to engage customers and connect with new ones, for sending newsletters, promoting events, and tracking results. More at ConstantContact.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, the teenage brain. We talk with neurologist Francis Jensen about how teenagers are more prone to risky behavior and addiction because their brains are still developing.
The effects of substances are more permanent on the teen brain. They have more deleterious effects and can be more toxic to the teen than in the adult.
Jensen has a new book. Join us.
And welcome back as we talk about the best-selling novel by Lisa Genova that has now become a movie. It's titled Still Alice, all about a woman, brilliant woman, professor at Harvard University, professor of linguistics, as a matter of fact, who does develop early Alzheimer's. Let's go now to Roz in East Ham, Massachusetts. Hi there, Roz. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question for you and your guests is, I found the ending of the book very disappointing and unfortunate because in this particular case, this woman had three adult female children who were well off, who could take her at the end. Most of us do not have that luxury. And I thought that was, you know, you read the book, you're looking for answers, and bingo, well, she's got a lot of money, and she's got kids who have a lot of money, and look, her adult children can take her into their home. I thought that was a cop-out. I'm just interested to know what you think about that.
No, I agree with you. I think that the end of the book, there were some very pat answers there. As I said earlier, they had, without us understanding how it had come about, they had resolved the issue. The father was living in New York. The daughter, who had been living in California, had moved back to the East Coast very conveniently. The two daughters were clearly taking turns. It was idyllic. I mean, that is an idyllic solution. And as I said, the book ended with her still cognizant, you know, not completely gone, I don't think.
That's why they call it fiction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's fiction. And here is a clip from the end of the movie, which really underscores the point you've just made, both of you.
What's it like? Like, what does it actually feel like?
Well, it's not always the same. You know, I have good days, bad days, and on my good days, I can, you know, almost pass for a normal person. But on my bad days, I feel like I can't find myself. I've always been so defined by my intellect, my language, my articulation, and now sometimes I can see the words hanging in front of me and I can't reach them and I don't know who I am and I don't know what I'm going to lose next.
And in fact, there she is, still Alice. How about your grandmother, Stefan? Was she still Nana?
You know, it is a really vexing question. I mean, she, according to my mother's theory, you know, she became, you know, I agree with what Lynn said about the end of the book, that it is, you know, a little simple, maybe a little pat. But in some ways, I also think that Lisa Genova's onto something, which is that, you know, in these mid stages, you know, and actually what we just heard from Julianne Moore's, you know, performance of this book, That's still the mid-stages where there's a lot of confusion, a lot of frustration,
right,
and anger.
Right, and her daughter is right there in front of her. That's right. Asking her.
And then, but in the late stages, what I saw in my grandmother was a brightening of her character. She seemed more joyful. She was more affectionate. And I think that happens to Alice at the end of this novel as well. It doesn't always happen. I'm not saying that Alzheimer's is, at the end, a happy fate, but that it is possible that, you know, at the end it becomes hell for everyone around the sufferer. But for the sufferer themselves, they enter into this sort of, you know, childlike connection with the world that maybe isn't so terrible.
Trish?
Well, you know, I saw a woman, my mom became sort of like Emily in Ours Town. You know, she was able to access her past, but not her now. And when she got to the end, she, of course, didn't know, or at least she couldn't express who she was. I always knew she loved me. You know, she still remembered love, and maybe that's the defining moment.
You know, my own mother, I was just talking to the doctor about this, that I don't think she had Alzheimer's, but she had a form of dementia. And I totally believe she knew who I was, although I don't think she could have said, "You're Lynn, my youngest daughter." But the relationship we had existed till the very end. I believe that. But at the same time, I also, not with her, but with my father, who had had a stroke, spent some time in a nursing home. And I saw people at end stages Alzheimer's who were just lying in bed and had no real recognition. And I think that this book doesn't get to that at all, nor does it get to the complexity of long-term care, the expense of long-term care. Right. These are the really tough issues around Alzheimer's that I think that caller was referring to.
And here's an email from Diane. She is in Rocky River, Ohio. She says, "I just lost my sister. She was only 62, was diagnosed 5 years ago. I'm here to tell you it's not that uncommon. While taking care of her and finding an assisted living facility for her to live in, I came across dozens of young people with this illness. I want to ask you, is it becoming more common? Howard.
Is the early onset more common? Probably not. It may be better recognized. The families are relatively well identified in most circumstances, although interestingly, the book does present her father as having some alcoholism and was thought on that basis that whatever cognitive problems he had was owing to that. But as we are likely to infer, he probably carried the gene. So
she goes on to say the last 2 years of her life were hell. And I cannot get past how frightened she was all the time, including the day she died. None of the drugs she took helped her at all. And we need to change this. Are there any drugs out there that really help Alzheimer's?
There is no drug yet that we have in our clinical armamentarium that modifies the natural history of this disease. And that's really the challenge for all of us is, one, to augment the type of clinical trials that Trish spoke about earlier. This is an advocacy issue. And the second is we need individuals to really be part of our solution, which is to volunteer in clinical studies, because there will be an opportunity.
Who do you think this book was written for, Lynn?
Huh, that's an interesting question. You know, again, I would have said it wasn't written for me because my initial instinct was, I don't want to read a novel about Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And the book that you mentioned earlier, Stefan, the We Are Not Ourselves, was another book that I thought, this was a family named Leary from Westchester County.
Right.
I'm an Irish Catholic girl from Westchester County named Neary, and I thought, I don't want to read that book, you know. That was my instinct. But I have issues with the book, but I think it really did give me a perspective on Alzheimer's that I had never seen before, and I thought that was interesting. So I think it's very much written for a wide audience. I mean, I think it's meant to reach a lot of readers who might not otherwise know anything about Alzheimer's or be exposed to it, and I think it's doing that.
That's what I was saying earlier. You know, Alzheimer's fiction has a vital role in Alzheimer's disease because, you know, what everyone wants to know when they are diagnosed or their loved ones are diagnosed is what can we expect. And I think this book is really targeted to those people. It works. It's not literary fiction. It's serving two roles, and one is to tell a moving story, but I think there's a deeper purpose Genova has in mind, which is to give us an inside tour of what this hell is going to be like. You know, the book has you know, treatment strategies and useful websites tucked in, which I think a lot of people find really useful.
Did you feel the book served that purpose, Trish?
I thought it made an opening. You know, it gave access to people that they could read something and care about something and bring out of the shadows, perhaps, hopefully, Alzheimer's to a public that seems to not want to know.
Exactly.
Like you didn't want to read it. It's not happy, but it's needed. And you know, and then it becomes up to us. We're their voices because they have no voice.
Exactly.
To demand change.
Let's go to John in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes. Thanks, Diane. And start with the book title. Is just fantastic. So that, and that's kind of the main point I was making about the people are still there. I work over the years with about 50 different Alzheimer's patients, and only about 3 or 4 at the end stage where it's bad for the patient, easily known. But they live in the moment. Everyone wants to live in the moment. Go visit a stranger. If you do it regularly, try to come with a friend because you probably need to debrief, joke around about what was amusing, blah, blah, blah. And I think as much as the fundraising, as much as other things, medicine is great, but right now people can visit, and in living moment to moment, they are happy. I'm sorry that the suicide thinking was there in the movie, because it's probably as much as other elderly people.
Well, that suicide scene seems to me quite realistic, that one does not want to live through the worst of what one knows is going to be a decline.
You know, I think what I was saying earlier about the sort of prevalent understanding of what happens to a self in Alzheimer's disease is, you know, this feeling that you're going to be like trapped inside of your own skin. And I think most Alzheimer's depictions in film and in literature show that. They show a person struggling, you know, to get out and lost inside of themselves. And that's a really dangerous depiction, because what it does is it, you know, it's really frustrating to the caretakers, because you feel like you can just reach in there and grab the person back out. And it's scary for the sufferers, because they're constantly being reminded of things they can't understand. So I think the caller's comment is exactly right, that, you know, and I think Genova shows this well, too, that you, with Alzheimer's disease, you really have to connect with the person as they are in that moment.
Exactly. Here's an email from Matt in Houston. What are your opinions on early genetic testing for Alzheimer's? If you're positive for genetic markers, one could feel a sense of impending doom. Every forgotten word, a harbinger of what's to come. But at the same time, early testing is integral to knowing whether or not preventive treatments can be effective. And before you answer, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Stefan.
Gosh, I mean, I think genetic testing is, you know, we've sort of returned to this moment where of bait, you know, and I think in the 20th century, we like to think of ourselves as, you know, things that we created. But I think, you know, that our destinies weren't predetermined. But now, you know, in this very real way, our history, our family's history, and I certainly feel this with my family's history, could become our destiny.
Would you consider genetic testing?
You know, I think I personally would not. I don't have the autosomal dominant form of Alzheimer's that the family in Still Alice does. In that case, when there's a really good chance of passing it on to your children, when you could develop Alzheimer's disease in your 40s as you're still, you know, a parent, I think you have a certain, I mean, in my opinion, a certain responsibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my family's case, we seem to develop Alzheimer's. And, you know, it's widespread in my mother's, it's basically everyone for generations going back develops it in their, you know, 70s. And so, you know, I think if I could have a yes or no for that, I don't think I would choose to know.
Trish?
Well, my mother and grandmother both had it. You know, two-thirds of people with Alzheimer's are women. So, in fact, I thought in Still Alice, that Alice probably got it from her mother, who died too early for her to develop Alzheimer's. So genetic testing, I'm really craven. I mean, I don't want to know unless there's something I can do about it. Whereas one of my closest friends, Meryl Comer, has done it, and I think she will go into different trials for this, and God knows we need that.
How many trials are actually going on now, Howard?
Well, for this form, relatively few, but there are several that I think are remarkable insofar as they have used the genetic tests for these familial patients to identify those who have 100% chance of developing the disease. And in some cases, they've actually enrolled them when they are asymptomatic, testing a set of drugs that are focused on the accumulation of amyloid, the A-beta that then produces amyloid. In late-onset Alzheimer's disease, there are many, many trials that are still open and enrolling. And I think the most important message for everyone who is in this arena, whether they be a patient, a family member, or a clinician, it is important to discuss whether participating in a clinical trial is in your interest. And moreover, participation means that you're actually going to have access sometimes to agents that may progress to being used clinically. But sometimes you can be randomized and not receive a an active agent, as all was
right.
this trial.
Last question, Lynn Neary. You didn't want to read this book particularly. Would you now recommend it?
I would recommend it. I mean, I think it's a very good read, I have to say. It's you know, and as I said, you can read it in a night practically, or certainly over a weekend. And it just keeps you really interested. And as I've said several times, it's a different perspective. You're really looking at it from Alice's perspective, and that's great.
Read for us just a tiny bit of her closing monologue.
Yeah, well, this is a terrible assignment because I just saw Julianne Moore deliver almost the same speech, so I'm going to mungle this up. There's a couple paragraphs I think are so beautiful, though. I often fear tomorrow. What if I wake up and don't know who my husband is? What if I don't know where I am or recognize myself in the mirror? Will I no longer be me? Is the part of my brain that's responsible for my unique meanness is vulnerable to the disease? Or is my identity something that transcends neurons?
Stephen Merrill Block, Trish Bradenburg, Howard Fedorov, Lynn Neary. The book, Lisa Genova's book, Still Alice. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.